It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Wisconsin's health department says the mineral fluoride can stop or even reverse tooth decay. But opponents who argue against tap water fluoridation raise concerns about human health. We break down some of these issues, and you can join the conversation. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Bruce Lanphier is a professor of health sciences at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, Canada. Also co-founder of Little Things Matter, that's a non-governmental organization dedicated to protecting children from toxic chemicals. Dr. Lanphier, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Yes, and Dr. Chris Hansen here as well, president of the Wisconsin Dental Association and a retired dentist in Manitowoc. Dr. Hansen, welcome.
Thank you, Kate. Thanks for having me on the show today. I feel like a longtime listener, first-time caller.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that.
I go back to the Tom Clark.
You go way back.
I go way back. Yeah, Tom Clark days, chapter day.
And, I should stress retired dentist, right?
I'm retired, yes, but still active.
Well,
active senior.
Let's start with you. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention include fluoridation of community water on its list of the 10 great public health achievements of the 20th century. What are fluoride's contributions to public health? Let's take stock here.
Well, I think it has a long and storied track record of being very, very good at causing remineralization of damaged tooth structure. Also, it has antibacterial properties, which prevent bacterial activity from causing decay in the first place. And I think it has a long history of being very safe, and also it's been very proven to reduce decay rates when used at optimal levels.
But isn't using like fluoride toothpaste enough, or getting a fluoride wash perhaps at the dentist during a cleaning?
That can help, and that contributes to the preventative nature of using fluorides. But we're finding that in some cases where you have segments of our population who have less access to the healthcare system are not benefiting from the benefits of fluoride protection to prevent decay. And in those cases, those are probably the most vulnerable people in our society, the poor, people who are in nursing homes in some cases, or in group homes, and don't have access to the healthcare system as regularly to take advantage of the fluoride applications that can be provided at those levels.
Turning to you, Dr. Lanphier, you have spent years studying exposure to low levels of lead. How has that work informed your approach to studying the risks of fluoride in drinking water?
Well, very much so. We use very much the same approach. We use the same kind of study design. We measured the same kinds of characteristics of the populations, and we use the same kind of interdisciplinary team. Here, we replaced the amount of lead in blood, which is what we use for lead poisoning, with three different measures. And the study we did in Canada, how much fluoride is in mother's urine. That's one way to measure exposure during pregnancy. How much fluoride was in the tap water they drank. And then incorporating fluoride in tap water plus other sources of fluoride in a daily diet like black tea, we had an estimate of fluoride intake.
What did you find there? Can you give some insight?
Yeah, well, our study was very consistent with most of the other studies. And what we found was that as the amount of fluoride in mother's urine increased, we saw decrements in the IQ scores, the intellectual ability of their children. So for example, an increase in the amount of fluoride was in pregnant women was associated with about a 3 to 5 decrement in IQ scores of their children. The second thing we found that was quite striking, and it's only been found in one other study, so it's relatively new, is that as the amount of fluoride in drinking water increased for the pregnant women, for the moms, we saw an increase in the risk of low thyroid.
How can you be sure that fluoride is the culprit?
It's a great question. And the most important thing we can do is replicate the study. And so there are over 19 high quality studies. This is based upon work out of the National Toxicology Program at the National Institute of Health in the United States. And what they found in those high quality studies is a consistent association as the amount of fluoride in drinking water or maternal urine increased, they saw decrements in children's IQ scores. So it's replication and seeing the same pattern, the same results across many different studies is the most important way to see that this is not just spurious or one study.
We're talking about fluoridation of drinking water with Simon Fraser University Professor Dr. Bruce Lanphier there, and Wisconsin Dental Association President Dr. Chris Hansen is here as well. Call in with a question along the way. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Hansen, your organization says nearly 90% of Wisconsin residents have access to fluoridated public water supplies. It also means more than a 500,000 people in our state don't receive the health benefits from fluoride in their tap water. How significant is the lack of fluoridation for these Wisconsin residents?
Well, we feel that if they don't have access to the fluoridated water, they hopefully have access to the healthcare system where they can use a fluoridated means to treat their teeth, both using toothpaste, which have fluoride content in them, and also with a topical application of fluoride varnishes and fluoride gels, and also using sodium diamine fluoride, which is a topical application of a material that has fluoride and also will tend to arrest the development of decay that has already started. So I think that, you know, we hope that we have more coverage for those patients. And the concern we have is that if they don't have access to the healthcare system, they're not going to benefit from that.
So they won't benefit from that. Since 2013, about 20 Wisconsin communities have stopped fluoridating their drinking water. That's according to the Fluoride Action Network. Do you see that as a trend? What is your response?
Well, whenever we are encountering a situation like that, where there is an active campaign to remove fluoride from a community water system, we also will be involved with the public hearing that does occur with that. And we probably present our case as far as the need and also the benefit that public fluoridation has for reducing dental decay. And in many cases, we've had that those community groups and the fluoridation entities will reverse their decision, and also will tend to want to put fluoride back in the water. So again, I think it's an advocacy thing. We have to really make our case before the public, make our case to the public hearings, and to really show the major benefits that occur with having fluoridation in the water, and that really help the overall dental health.
But I wonder, are all fluoride additives created equal? Like, how can people judge the quality and safety of the fluoride additives being used in their water system?
Well, I think that's highly regulated by the EPA. Okay. And they regulate how the water systems are regulated and how much fluoride is put in there. And there's a standard that's set right now through the EPA of 0.7 milligrams per liter, which is like less than one part per million of water in the water system. And we've found it through the studies that we have lots of studies that back up, a lot of robust studies that really indicate that has an incredibly good effect on decreasing decay prevalence in those cities.
Do you think has water fluoridation been thoroughly studied, or is there enough evidence, as Dr. Lanphier has been talking about, to have a need to look further into this mineral and what it is doing?
Okay, and I think that there are tons of studies. This is water fluoridation has been used for over 75 years in this country, and also it has been studied thoroughly. And again, I sent a link there's a document that is available through the American Dental Association called Fluoridation Facts, and you can go on ADA's website and get that document, download it, and you can have all the information, all the studies, and right in front of me, I've got 15 studies from 2011 that indicate the safety and efficacy of fluoride. And they've been studied in meta studies, large group studies, comparison studies. And I think that it is the preponderance of evidence is pretty overwhelming in terms of the benefit of fluoride in terms of improving dental health. I think that science and medicine and dentistry, it's an iterative process. It's ongoing, and we're always looking at research and trying to improve it and making sure that the safety is still a major factor for providing this fluoride for dental health reasons. But I think it's an ongoing process. Lots of study that's out there. There's lots of information. I think it really was very, very helpful to have more information and also more study.
Dr. Lanfear, where do you see the evolution of research in this area of fluoride and more work to be done?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is to recognize that in the past, up until about 20 years ago, most of the studies looking at safety were looking at tooth modeling, the discoloration of teeth. It's really only been in the last two decades that we've been looking more carefully at fluoride and its impact on intellectual ability or brain function in children. And I should say that where we really focused most of our research and where we see the impact is in early brain development during pregnancy when the child's brain is developing and in infancy. That's where we see the greatest impact. And so what we focused on is not water fluoridation overall, but the impact on the developing brain. So what the mother drinks is really important, whether that's fluoridated water, whether that's black tea. And so what we've advised is for mothers, and this includes my own daughters, to avoid fluoride during pregnancy. Use fluoride toothpaste for sure, but during that time period, avoid drinking fluoridated water and black tea. As well, make sure you do not mix formula with fluoridated tap water. That should be free of fluoride because the developing infant first has no teeth and therefore gets no erupted teeth and therefore gets no benefit. That's what my dental expert colleagues tell me. And yet they can have modeling, and we do see evidence of IQ decrement. So what we're really focused on is this very short window of exposure where we recommend that women use fluoridated toothpaste if that's their choice. But we feel like we need to make sure that we're protecting them. And from the medical perspective, the way I would think about that is first, do no harm.
Dr. Bruce Lanfear, a health sciences professor at Simon Fraser University. Dr. Chris Hansen is here, president of the Wisconsin Dental Association, as we discuss developments over fluoride in drinking water. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We explore the future of fluoride in tap water. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention highlights research studies that elevate the safety and benefits of fluoridated water, leading to better dental health. And opponents raise potential safety and health concerns. Call in with a question. Share your perspective. 800-642-1234. Dr. Chris Hansen is president of the Wisconsin Dental Association. Dr. Bruce Lanfear is here, professor of health sciences at Simon Fraser University in Canada. Dr. Hansen, in 2015, the CDC lowered its recommended level to 0.7 milligrams of fluoride per liter of water, and that is not a federal mandate. Individual communities can determine whether to fluoridate their water supply, as we talked about. How do you think should fluoridation be regulated?
I think it is regulated now. I think it should be regulated at the state and local levels, depending on the quality of water that they have at the local level. There's a lot of naturally occurring fluoride sources that are there, And I think that it is just important that they regulate it. The EPA gives a the level that is recommended through the United States Public Health Service, but it is up to local boards to really determine that. And I don't think it should be something that should be a one size fits all mandate from the federal government on down, but it is strongly recommended.
Dr. Lanphier, you were called as an expert witness for plaintiffs currently suing the Environmental Protection Agency over the fluoridation of drinking water. What do you hope will come of the court case in San Francisco?
Well, what I hope is that the newer science is brought to bear. And I think one of the things that we need to recognize is that as new science is published, it usually takes 10 or 20 years anyway for that to be incorporated into policy or regulation. So for example, it was in the year 2000, we found evidence that there was no safe level of lead in children's blood. We confirmed that in 2003 and again in 2005. It wasn't really until 2012 that the Centers for Disease Control acknowledged that. And even then, it still took several more years before we really started under the Biden administration to tackle the amount of lead in drinking water. Through because of the lead service lines. And so for me, one of the most important things as new science is evolving is that I want to make sure that the public, and in this case in particular, pregnant moms, families, have the access to this kind of information so they can make their own choice, because I recognize that it's going to take time, not only for the public, but even for dentists and public health officials to incorporate this new evidence.
Is it difficult for the public who are outside the medical community to understand the dynamics with fluoride or what is happening? Because there is a lot of noise, as we would say. There is a lot of competing information.
Absolutely. And it's really challenging, but I think it's one of the most important things. And that's why we created Little Things Matter, is to try to take this science, which can be quite complicated, there's a jargon attached to it, but to make it accessible. And if you look at history, what you'll see time and again is we need good science to make progress in public health, but we also need an informed public. And especially mothers have been at the forefront of asking questions, and when the evidence is clear and convincing, demanding change. And so that's why we created this group, Little Things Matter, to make that kind of information accessible.
We're talking about fluoridation of drinking water. That's Dr. Bruce Lanphier at Simon Fraser University. And Dr. Chris Hansen is here, Wisconsin Dental Association president. Call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Dr. Hansen, the CDC says drinking fluoridated water reduces tooth decay by roughly 25% in children and adults. Could the same result be achieved by other means?
I think that the achievement of this reduction is a combination of factors of using the fluoride that's available in toothpaste, fluoride that's available professionally by fluoride treatments, and also the low level or effect of having low levels of fluoride in tap water to drink. And I think that these all are additive, and these all are important to be part of the mix in terms of helping to reduce the decay level. And I think that is the goal that we have, is that we want to reduce the level of dental disease. We want to reduce the level of decay, and also try to protect those parts of our society that are at most vulnerable, most at risk. And so I think we feel this is, again, more of a passive means of allowing some of that fluoride to get into those areas where they always don't have access to healthcare, practitioners.
Dr. Lanphier, are you concerned or encouraged that your research is being used by groups that want to end fluoridation of drinking water?
I'm not quite sure whether I'm. I guess the main thing for me is as science evolves, as we begin to understand new benefits and harms, that we acknowledge it, that we take it into account. And at a minimum, the evidence is compelling enough that it's time for our dental community and our public health community to step back and ask questions and be willing to question old beliefs to make sure that In fact, fluoride is not causing harm. And Dr. Hansen mentioned how we need to make sure that we're protecting those without means. And absolutely, that's true. But there's kind of an interesting dilemma here. And that is, to the extent that water fluoride is causing problems with intellectual ability in children or hypothyroidism, which that second part still needs to be tested. Now we're creating a situation where they may not be able to afford water filtration during pregnancy. So it's a big, important question.
Well, thank you both for joining us. That is Dr. Bruce Lanphier, professor of health sciences at Simon Fraser University. Dr. Chris Hansen, president of the Wisconsin Dental Association. You're listening to The Morning Show on the IDS Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We head to the South Pole and learn about the latest weather discoveries at the Antarctic Meteorological Research Center. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Sarah Hopeful with a story about an historical Wisconsin musician.
Drummer Viola Smith was a musical trailblazer and innovator. Known as the fastest girl drummer in the world, her career lasted almost 100 years. Author Dean Robbins took a trip to her hometown in Fond du Lac County to tell us more about this legend.
Mount Calvary has only a few hundred residents, but it produced a drummer of national significance. She was born in 1912, and if you stop modern-day residents on the main drag, they still know her name.
Viola Smith.
Viola Smith's father owned a ballroom in Mount Calvary, and townsfolk showed me where it once stood on Fond du Lac Street. Mr. Smith enlisted his older daughters for the jazzy Smith Sisters Orchestra, featuring trumpet, trombone, and saxophone. By the time Viola was ready to join the family band at age 13, she told the Women in Rock Oral History Project that it still lacked a key instrument.
And he had these eight girls all play piano, and then he'd put them on different instruments. And I was so lucky to be the sixth one. As a sixth one, I was a drummer.
Young Viola tried smacking the snare and socking the cymbals, and she fell in love with the drums. The Smith sisters went on the road in the 1920s as a rare all-female band at Wisconsin fairs and vaudeville theaters. Viola studied other drummers on the circuit and developed her own flashy way of playing. One by one, Viola's sisters left music for other pursuits, but she yearned to keep playing, even though female instrumentalists were not welcome in most male orchestras. So in 1939, Smith formed her own women's jazz band called the Coquettes to showcase her razzle-dazzle style. She placed her 12-piece kit on a tall platform with a giant tom-tom by each shoulder. This innovation wowed the crowds when Smith rapped out rhythms at blazing speed. To end the numbers with a flourish, she bounced her sticks off a drum head and caught them in midair. Smith's fame spread as a technical marvel, earning her the nickname the fastest girl drummer in the world. In 1940, Billboard magazine splashed her on its cover. She remembers that time with the Women in Rock Oral History Project.
That I was doing something that nobody else was doing, and that's what helped me a lot, I'm sure.
In 1942, men were leaving jazz bands to fight in World War II, and Smith saw a chance to boost women instrumentalists. She wrote an influential article for Downbeat magazine called Give Girl Musicians a Break. It urged band leaders to hire these overlooked players.
Oh, the girl musicians were so happy about this because I mentioned so many girl names, all the girls I knew. Good musicians.
Smith later toured as a solo act with a spectacular 17-piece drum kit. She even studied classical music at Juilliard and joined the National Symphony Orchestra as a timpanist. In 2000, Lincoln Center for the Arts honored her as a jazz legend. Smith continued to smack her snare and sock her cymbals past the age of 100, defying our conventional view of older women. She died in 2020 at the age of 107, a hero to generations of female instrumentalists who followed her into the music business. It's no wonder people still know Viola Smith's name in Mount Calvary. Who could forget the fastest girl drummer in the world?
It was all fun, but drumming is fun.
Author Dean Robbins of Madison brought us that story on Viola Smith. He's written a children's picture book about the musician, the fastest drummer. Clap your hands for Viola Smith. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Sarah Hopeful.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We check in on climate developments at the Earth's axis and the melting of ice sheets. Dozens of Antarctica's weather stations, they're monitored by Wisconsin researchers. Call in with a question. Share your comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. David Mikolajczyk is a researcher at the Antarctic Meteorological Research and Data Center. The Wisconsin-based project is a collaboration between UW-Madison and Madison Area Technical College. David, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So your research with the Antarctic Center is based here at UW-Madison, but you recently visited the icy continent. Can you tell us about that visit and what you learned?
Yeah, so this past November to early January, I deployed to Antarctica. And this is something that our group has done on an annual basis since we started working on the weather station program in Antarctica since 1980. And so every year we go down to maintain our automatic weather station network. This year in particular, we had a predetermined list of approximately 20 automatic weather stations that we were hoping to visit to fix up any instruments that may have been broken, dig up any sites that may have been buried, things like that. So the primary work that we do is actually more of like being a field technician rather than actually doing the research when we're in Antarctica itself. Because our weather station network is always transmitting the data back real time to us. And so we can see that data, like, for example, right now, I'm seeing that the coldest temperature in Antarctica from our network is negative 77 degrees Fahrenheit in East Antarctica. So we get to do the research when we're back home. When we're down there, we
you're doing tune-ups.
Fix
yeah.
the sites.
Yeah, you're doing tune-ups from site to site, right?
Yep.
I'm wondering if you notice visible changes between your visits in the melting landscape, or does it seem very similar when you arrived from the last time you went?
Yeah. For most of the sites I'm to, it looks pretty similar. Actually, the biggest difference that I'll usually notice is that the site has more snow accumulation at it than in a few years ago. And that's mostly simply because of the snow that accumulates at the site. Some sites do get falling precipitation, of course, as well. But for most of the sites we go to, I haven't noticed a huge change. But I know that there has been a lot of variability in, for example, the sea ice in the surrounding Southern Ocean, something that we can't see from our sites itself, but has been noticed.
Because your weather stations are mostly inland and not near the continent's coasts, near the ocean. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, we have a few that are on the coast, but okay. The large majority are inland, either on ice or on islands that are kind of near the coast, but still on land. And then a lot of them that are on ice shelves or the ice sheets over the continent itself.
on the ice shelves or on the ice sheets. And we're going to talk about those ice sheets in a moment. But in terms of these weather stations, how durable are they and how reliable are they as they, you know, send you this vital research information and capture it and send it back to you like in real time?
Mm-hmm. They are extremely durable until they break. And Antarctica is a very harsh continent. So actually it's it varies on the location that they are installed. And so it's in Antarctica are a little nicer to our weather stations. And actually one site that I visited this past season, it's called Letau, but it hadn't really been serviced for 10 years. And it was still giving us rock solid data that whole time. Whereas at another location that's near McMurdo Station, where we base most of our operations in Antarctica, it's called Minna Bluff. And that site gets very windy and gets a lot of rime ice and snow accumulation on the sensors themselves. And so that site, its instruments break usually on an annual basis. And so we had to go to that site as well this year and totally swap out all the instruments on that. So it does vary by location, how durable the sites are, but we monitor the data as it comes in. And if we see things data that starts to look a little off, then we'll note that and probably have to visit it in the coming field season.
Do like penguins ever meddle with the equipment?
We've never recorded such an incident, but we don't leave it out of the realm of possibility. No, in all seriousness, I don't think they do. And we only have a few sites that are located near penguin rookeries. But as far as we can tell, they're mostly just curious about it and respectful of our weather stations.
I love that answer. That's wonderful. So, you know, as you look at the information on these ice sheets, and we know that there is significant melting underway at the coasts. Are the ice shelves on the east and west sides of Antarctica, are they deteriorating in like similar ways?
It depends on the location once again. And so in West Antarctica, there's a glacier called Thwaites Glacier. And I've seen the to as the Doomsday Glacier in a lot of articles and such. And it is that Thwaites Glacier in West Antarctica is retreating and deteriorating very quickly. And that has significant implications for the stability of the entire West Antarctic ice sheet, because the Thwaites Glacier and the ice shelf that forms from that glacier flowing off of the land and onto the surrounding sea. The ice shelf itself is breaking up. And when that breaks up, that causes the ice sheet to flow off the land more quickly. And so there's numerous floating ice shelves around the continent of Antarctica. And so if those start breaking up more quickly, then the ice sheets on the land flow off the land more quickly into the ocean, melt, and then you can get changes in the ice sheet surface mass balance and things like that. In East Antarctica, I'm not exactly sure about all of the status of the ice sheets, the floating ice shelves in that region. Although one thing that our study that was published a month ago found about the Conger ice shelf in East Antarctica is that ice shelf, due to this heat wave that we found and the strong weather systems associated with it near Antarctica, that accelerated the breakup of that ice shelf. And so there are things that can happen, such as strong weather systems, to help break up ice shelves.
David Mikolajczyk is a researcher for the Antarctic Meteorological Research and Data Center. You can be part of this conversation. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective. Call in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. Thank you. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We focus on the southernmost continent and the site of South Pole research. It's where Wisconsin scientists maintain dozens of weather stations to monitor temperatures, the changing climate, impacts of extreme weather events. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. David Mikolajczyk is a researcher with the Antarctic Meteorological Research and Data Center, recently returned from the South Pole. Let's take a call now. Jim in Kenosha is here. Jim, hi.
Yes, my sister was in New Zealand for a while, and on the south end is where a lot of the Antarctic expeditions travel, and she met some of those pilots, and they were up there with the brain surgeons and the astronauts. And I just wanted you to have a quick comment about the last leg of your journey into Antarctica. What's the travel like?
Thank you, Jim.
It is, it's a fun little leg there. It's fun to go through New Zealand, and that's a beautiful country. And when we fly into New Zealand, we fly on commercial airlines from the United States, and then we get fitted with our cold weather gear through the United States Antarctic Program that's based out of Christchurch, New Zealand. And once we get that cold weather gear, then we get assigned a flight time and a flight date, usually in a day or two after that. And then we just wait for the flight day. As long as weather is good, then we're flying on either a Hercules LC-130 aircraft or a C-17. And so big military planes, but then it's a between 5 and 8 hour flight from Christchurch down to McMurdo Station, Antarctica.
So what provisions do you take with you? And then what do you do with your trash?
We throw away trash just as normal in McMurdo, but that trash itself is packed, loaded up onto ships that once a year come down to McMurdo Station and remove all that trash from Antarctica and ship it back north, actually. So it's a whole big process to do that. And as far as our provisions, we usually bring normal type clothes and everything as one might do for a week or two long trip. And then as well, of course, some of our own personal cold weather gear like winter jackets and hats and gloves.
Getting back to your study where researchers with the center, you know, published a study that found record warm temperatures in 2022, what is considered warm for Antarctica?
Well, in this particular case, warm was 15 degrees Fahrenheit. And so actually at this location, at one of our weather stations at Dome C in East Antarctica. It's very high up, high elevation in the middle of the East Antarctic ice sheet. Its average temperatures in March are around negative 64 Fahrenheit, but in March 18th, 2022, it got to a record warm temperature of 15 Fahrenheit. And so in the middle of the Antarctic continent, temperatures like that are very warm. And so we noticed that there's a large region of East Antarctica that experienced record warmth such as this.
And that led to that heat wave, if you will, led to this great deterioration of an ice shelf itself.
Yes. Yep. My boss, Matthew Lazara, who's the principal investigator of our project, as well as 52 other collaborating scientists from institutions across around the world, found that there was connections from tropical weather activity in the tropics that led to a strong atmospheric river and an extratropical a cyclone around Antarctica. And those strong weather systems led indeed to the deterioration of that ice shelf, as well as a lot of precipitation and some record warm temperatures.
As you examine these types of climate patterns, I mean, we can't help but notice Wisconsin experiencing an historically warm winter. Are Antarctica climate patterns affecting the weather here in Wisconsin?
I haven't studied a direct impact between, you know, if the temperature gets warm in Antarctica today, how does that affect Wisconsin today or tomorrow? But there are implications for such connections and weather and climate signals such as this. And so we've had a very strong El Nino, which is a climate signal that can affect
weather patterns in Wisconsin and the United States, and it affects various places around the world in different ways. And so our ability to monitor the weather in Antarctica and then connect that back to any potential climate signal impacts can help us understand how those different climate signals, such as El Nino, can impact places further afield, such as Antarctica and, of course, Wisconsin.
David Mikolajczyk of the Antarctic Meteorological Research and Data Center at UW-Madison. Call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. John in Boaz is here. John, hi.
Good morning. I'd like to ask your guest if the Earth's axis on the South Pole is rotated every day, well, does the South Pole magnetically have a moving effect like on the North Pole, and is there southern lights?
Thank you, John. David?
Yes, the South Magnetic Pole does indeed move, and that moves around a fair amount. This is a bit out of my area of expertise, but I do know that over the course of years and decades, the magnetic pole has moved in different locations around the continent. And while I've never been to Antarctica in its wintertime when it's night, they do indeed have southern lights, and I've heard they are beautiful. I've never seen them because when we go to Antarctica, we go during the summer when it's 24 hours of sunlight. So unfortunately, I don't get to see the southern lights then, but I've heard they're gorgeous.
Why should weather monitoring continue in Antarctica? How vital are these stations?
Having weather stations monitoring the weather in Antarctica is just another piece of the whole weather and climate puzzle that we are learning more and more about as we have these weather stations recording data year-round. And as we've grown the network over the years, that's helped us fill that data void. And so having that data available to us, and especially for a long period of time, has helped us understand the global weather and climate connections.
In our last moments together, have your visits impacted how you lead your life and your carbon footprint?
A bit, yeah. I've noticed that, especially around town in McMurdo, people are very cognizant of the waste that they create, just with trash and recycling and things like that, as well as, and so I'm a little bit more cognizant of that. Also, with the long travel times and just flying from the United States down to Antarctica, as well as going to our different sites, I'm more aware of the impact that has on the planet.
David, thank you for joining us and sharing the research.
Thank you very much for having me.
David Mikolajczyk, researcher for the Antarctic Meteorological Research and Data Center. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Three NASA astronauts and a Russian cosmonaut arrive at the International Space Station for a six-month stay. Here's Crew 8 co-pilot Michael Barrett in remarks at the hatch opening, talking with Mission Control at Space Center Houston.
Just a big shout-out to all the folks who got us up here to NASA, our friends at SpaceX for building a great little spaceship and a little taste of the flexibility this morning that we'll be expecting over the next 6 months.
As we discuss lunar missions and the space economy, call in with a question. Share your comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jeff Faust is a senior staff writer for Space News. Jeff, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Good morning. Ryan Watkins here as well, program scientist in NASA's Exploration Science Strategy and Integration Office at the agency's headquarters in Washington, D.C. Ryan, welcome back.
Good morning, Kate.
Good morning. So, Ryan, you know, NASA's create their docking at the International Space Station. We see the swapping of crews, the hugs that are immediately occur, and the excitement. What might the crew be doing while they are in the low Earth orbit in this, you know, quote unquote floating laboratory?
Yeah, that's a good question. And just for context, I don't do a lot with the International Space Station side of things, mm-hmm. but I can tell you that the crew has a variety of activities that they're going to be doing while they're, you know, orbiting Earth on the ISS. They'll be conducting some experiments. You know, we've got scientific payloads and experiments that are on board the ISS. So they have time built into their daily schedules to do those. They're doing a lot of human biology experiments to understand what happens to the human body when you're in space for long durations of time. You know, they'll spend some time exercising. They'll do calls with children or other public engagement efforts. Basically, they stay pretty busy the whole time they're up there with very detailed schedules laid out for them.
It makes me wonder, though, is the International Space Station a good place for this type of work and collaboration that could perhaps one day be replicated on the moon? Or, you know, this cooperation that you see at this station, could that be applicable with what could happen on the moon?
Yeah, definitely. There are definitely also some differences between, you know, low Earth orbit and the lunar environment. You know, you've got differences in radiation and gravity and things like that. But low Earth orbit is a really great place for us to just understand the physiological effects of space on, again, on the human body and how we adapt to that in space or react to it. So it's a good place to kind of understand that before we go to the lunar surface or lunar orbit for longer periods of time. It's really great for, you know, fostering our international collaborations. You know, you see a lot of that on the ISS with different countries sending astronauts and resources and things. And that's something we hope to continue in low Earth orbit, as well as, you know, just learning how to conduct experiments, whether it be, you know, kind of in a space station type environment or adapting those to later be used on the surface of a planetary body. So there are a lot of really great analogs. We're learning a lot about just how to, you know, how humans and robots kind of interface and how we can use the humans to conduct experiments and do other things that we hope to do when we get to the lunar environment as well.
Turning to you, Jeff Faust at Space News, you know, so the SpaceX rocket holding Crew 8 delayed its launch for several days due to poor weather. What comes up for you as you see this crew change at the International Space Station?
Well, I think it's a demonstration of the growing role that the private sector is playing in spaceflight today. NASA used to use the space shuttle to send astronauts to the space station. Once the shuttle was retired in 2011, we had to rely on the Russians and their Soyuz spacecraft to get to the space station. But now we have SpaceX with their Crew Dragon spacecraft that is able to send astronauts to and from the space station and do so as a commercial service. SpaceX owns and operates the spacecraft, and basically NASA is using that spacecraft for its needs to support the ISS. And there's a second company, Boeing, developing its own crewed spacecraft called Starliner that will be flying to the space station with astronauts on board for the first time around the end of April. So it's a demonstration of the growing capabilities of the private sector that NASA can increasingly rely on as it focuses on some of the more critical deep space exploration activities it's performing.
So you would consider NASA to be like SpaceX's number one customer in a way at the moment?
Yeah, definitely. NASA is SpaceX's biggest customer, along with other parts of the federal government for satellite launches as well. But SpaceX obviously has a lot of commercial business as well. But certainly, you know, SpaceX and other companies are providing key capabilities that NASA increasingly relies on to carry out activities in low Earth orbit, like the space station, as it works on the Artemis program to send astronauts to the moon.
Talking with Jeff Faust, Space News senior staff writer, and Ryan Watkins is here, NASA program scientist, as we talk about the moon and space exploration. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Ryan, let's talk about the Artemis mission. In January, NASA announced its Artemis space program plans to land astronauts on the moon in 2026. How likely is that timeline?
Yeah, it's a great question. So 2026 is the timeline we're working towards for our first crewed mission through the Artemis program that will land on the surface of the moon. So this will be the first time we've sent humans back to the surface in over 50 years. So that is the timeline we're working towards. The announcement that came out in January was a delay from our original timeline of 2024. So the end of this year was the original goal. But you know, there's a lot of work that has to go into getting humans on another planetary body. So we're working towards that 2026 date, and that's holding right now. There is an Artemis 2 mission coming up before that, that will be an orbital mission. So we will have humans in orbit around the moon, but the first landing is 2026, I think
Okay.
September timeframe.
Why return astronauts to the moon? Why should this be a top priority for NASA?
Yeah, there's actually a lot of really great reasons to send humans back to the moon. Some of the three kind of primary reasons that NASA likes to think about are first and foremost scientific discovery. There are a lot of things that humans can do on the surface of the moon that robots just can't do as easily, at least, or as well. So when we sent Apollo to the moon, we really only explored a very small area on the surface of the moon. And so with Artemis, we're going to a whole new region. We're planning to go to the South Polar region of the moon, which is rich in resources that we can use for longer duration space flight. So things like, you know, water and oxygen and stuff that you need for crewed exploration. And so sending humans instead of just robots allows us to do things more efficiently, more quickly. You know, the human eye is well trained on recognizing certain samples and being like, that's the one that I need. Whereas with robots, you got a lot of iterations back and forth. You've got folks on, you know, the ground control side that have to analyze things and tell the robot where to go. So humans are just a lot more efficient in that regard. So it enables us to do a lot more scientific discovery by exploring a new region that has different, you know, rock types and resources and things that we didn't see with Apollo. There are also a lot of economic benefits to sending humans to the moon. We're also partnering with commercial companies, like Jeff just mentioned, for a lot of these efforts. You know, SpaceX and Blue Origin being two of them. There are others as well. We've got commercial vendors developing our spacesuits. You know, we're just doing a lot to really kind of build up a lunar economy and really boost some of these commercial companies as we look towards going back to the moon. And then finally, oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, and then I just, you know, there are these private companies trying to land things on the moon. And I want to bring up the first privately built spacecraft landing on the moon in February. And here is a former NPR science correspondent, Joe Palca, on our sister program, Central Time, discussing the Intuitive Machines lander.
It was always private companies that were involved. NASA doesn't make all this stuff itself. But now, this other company is running the show essentially, and the control room is on their in their building, not in NASA, a base around the country.
So, Jeff, how is the role of private companies in space exploration expanding?
Well, you know, as you mentioned, we're now using private companies to land payloads on the moon, something that used to only be done by big government space agencies. And with the Intuitive Machines landing last month, they were the first company to successfully land on the moon. All the previous landings on the moon, dating back to the beginning of the space age, more than 60 years ago, were done by governments, by NASA, by the Soviets, by China, India. Japan, they had all been done by government agencies. We've now seen the growth in private sector capabilities, much like we've seen that capabilities grow to support the International Space Station to be able to send payloads to the moon and one day send people to the moon to support the Artemis program. You know, and sort of being able to leverage these capabilities is a way to both grow the economy, but also to sort of, you know, leverage capabilities that allows NASA to focus on the sort of the really hard things that only a space agency can do.
Real hard things, Ryan. I'm wondering how much room for failure or how much trial and error is there for these companies learning to land things on the moon? I mean, there was concern that this lander had tipped over as it landed.
Yeah, no, that's a question we definitely get a lot with our Commercial Lunar Payload Services or CLPS program. So NASA is very aware of the risks of this program. It is kind of, you know, we're accepting a larger degree of risk than we may, you know, do with some of our other missions. You know, we're really committed to supporting our commercial vendors as they navigate these difficult tasks of sending, you know, scientific and technology payloads and demonstrations to the moon. And so there's not like a quantifiable answer to that, but we do recognize that there will be failures, there will be successes, there will be, you know, everything in between those two. You know, even with Intuitive Machines, while yes, they did tip over during landing, you know, we still got a lot of data, a lot of lessons learned, we got our payloads on. So we're kind of using all of those lessons moving forward, looking to our next flights to see, you know, how we can improve. We know that our commercial vendors are all learning from each other as well. They've been very open with their communication so far. And so, yeah, we're accepting a higher level of risk and just kind of evolving as we go.
Ryan Watkins there, a NASA program scientist focused on the moon. Jeff Faust, senior staff writer at Space News, as we discuss the latest on space exploration and the moon. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. NASA's budget would be nearly $24 billion under spending appropriations Congress is preparing to act on. That analysis in the journal Science, citing NASA's program funding is reduced in some areas due to Congress's growing uneasiness about rising costs for several major missions. As we discuss the space economy, call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We have Ryan Watkins, a program specialist at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. Jeff Faust is here, senior staff writer at Space News. Jeff, Congress has passed several resolutions in recent months to continue temporarily funding the government at current spending levels. Are these temporary spending measures affecting NASA's budget and its long-term plans?
Yeah, I mean, the stopgap funding bills force NASA to make decisions about how to support future programs for 2024 when they're not certain how much money they will eventually get when Congress passes that 2024 final spending bill. And one of the programs that was affected by that is called Mars Sample Return. And as the name suggests, it's a program to collect samples from the surface of Mars, which the Perseverance rover is doing right now, and then bring them back to Earth. And the separate House and Senate spending bills last year proposed vastly different amounts of money, more than a factor of three difference for Mars Sample Return. And so NASA went into this series of continuing resolutions or stopgap spending bills, deciding to assume that they would get only the lower level and plan accordingly so that they didn't spend too much before the final bills got passed. And what that led to is some cutbacks in the Mars Sample Return program, particularly at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, which is the lead center from our sample return, and that forced JPL to lay off more than 500 people, or about 8% of its workforce last month, because of that continued uncertainty. Now, that uncertainty is coming to an end. Congress is going to pass this week a final fiscal year 2024 spending bill. There's still some details up in the air about just how much money Mars Sample Return will get, but it'll provide a little bit more certainty for NASA in terms of how much money it will get overall. And so it can plan accordingly for Mars Sample Return and its other science and exploration programs.
But wouldn't these latest appropriations cut spending to NASA compared to 2023 levels?
Yeah, the bill would provide a little less than $25 billion for NASA overall in 2024. NASA got a little over $25 billion in 2023 and was asking for more than $27 billion for 2024. So to see your proposed budget get cut by effectively 10% from what you asked for requires tightening some belts. Now, that gets done unevenly across the agency because some programs get pretty much all the money that they requested, some see steeper cuts. So you have to go through really on a program-by-program basis, depending on how much money Congress allocates for them, and deciding, you know, what to cut, what to delay, and what can move forward.
Ryan, how could the flat spending or cuts by the federal government impact our lunar aspirations and our scientific discoveries for the moon?
Yeah, I think Jeff answered this one very well. Like he said, it's very program by program dependent. And so at least on the side where, you know, we're looking at lunar programs, you know, we currently have a lot of different things we're funding. We have Artemis, we have, you know, a variety of different programs, like even under Artemis with, you know, instruments and science teams and technology and all sorts of different things. And so the agency, we have, you know, like priorities. You know, Artemis is definitely one of those. It's very possible that the funding cuts could affect certain areas of that. You know, I don't know yet which ones. But probably what will happen is we'll look at some of our, you know, things that are prioritized maybe a little bit lower than Artemis and have to make some cuts there. We're very committed to, you know, continuing our funding for our high priority missions and objectives, which would include human lunar exploration. So again, there may be some areas where we see some funding cuts, but I don't think it will hurt the Artemis program overall too terribly. So we will continue to go forward with that.
Ryan Watkins there, NASA program scientist. Jeff Faust with us at Space News. Call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Jeff, these NASA contracts with private space companies, like we've talked about SpaceX, Blue Origin, for help with its lunar ambitions, what do you see into the future, the role of these types of companies in NASA missions?
Well, I think the role will continue to grow as these companies demonstrate their capabilities, and that will take some time. Inevitably, there will be some setbacks and such, but I think overall you're seeing it growing because it has been growing already for more than 15 years. We started with transporting cargo to the space station commercially. Now we're transporting astronauts to the space station commercially. We're sending, you know, robotic payloads to the moon with commercial landers. Soon we'll be doing that with astronauts. So we'll see those capabilities continue to grow so long as companies can demonstrate that they can, you know, fulfill their contracts with NASA.
In terms, Ryan, of how NASA is educating about the work it's doing. There's the blog sharing developments in the Artemis program. How accessible is NASA's space exploration information and its goals to the public who are not involved in these missions?
Yeah, I would say it's very accessible. Sometimes you just got to pick your favorite platform that you want to go get the information from. But so NASA does broadcast a lot of our information. We've got NASA TV. There's, you know, often live coverage there of not only, you know, ISS exploration with crew, but, you know, we've covered our CLPS launches and landings on there, and a whole other variety of things. You know, NASA's very active on X and Instagram and Facebook and all of those, you know, pick your favorite platform, mm-hmm. and we're on it. So the information is very accessible, and obviously you can always go to our website, nasa.gov as well.
And, you know, I was watching the hatch opening and the welcome remarks on the International Space Station, and I noticed as they gathered all the astronauts together, Mission Control Houston said, "Can you remove that wire that is sticking a little bit out? I see it in the picture. It's about, you know," to me, the untrained eye, I can see what they're talking about, but it demonstrated just how important that their image might be and how carefully they want that attention to detail in the image. And I'm just wondering, Ryan, what does that tell you, or does that speak to you in any way?
Yeah, I didn't see that particular clip, but when I see things like that, it always amazes me at just how well our teams are trained. You know, they see those things that, you know, us, you know, as the public might be watching and don't even notice. It shows that, you know, yeah, I mean, that maybe it's a public image thing of, hey, just get this wire out of the way so we have a good shot. Or maybe it's a safety thing, like, hey, get this wire out of the way, we don't want someone to trip on it. You know, there's probably multiple factors that go into that. NASA, you know, we're really good at, you know, just displaying all this stuff publicly. We're not trying to soften our image or anything, but, you know, we do want, you know, the public to be very excited about what they see when they're watching our astronauts. And so we do take great care and pride in that.
Ryan Watkins, NASA program scientist focused on the moon. Jeff Faust, senior staff writer at Space News. Call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We take stock of the U.S. space program, the growth of the commercial space industry with the likes of SpaceX and the effects of a global space competition for the moon's south pole, where scientists have detected traces of water ice. We'll get into that. Call in with a question. Add your perspective. 800-642-1234. We have Space News senior writer Jeff Faust with us and NASA program scientist Ryan Watkins here as well. Ryan, we heard from Frank in Springbrook, called in to ask, how many space missions will it take to set up a base on the moon? And Frank is also wondering about what will be the cargo needed and those logistics.
Yeah, that's a really great question. I don't think I have a number answer to give you. It will definitely take more than one. So with the Artemis program, we are looking towards, you know, establishing some kind of, you know, permanent or semi-permanent base in the south polar region of the moon. So it will take a lot of precursor missions to get the supplies up there that we need, you know, the habitats that the astronauts might live or work in. The resources they'll need, whether it be, you know, oxygen, food, et cetera. So I don't know exactly how many, but that's definitely something that NASA is actively thinking about and working towards. I don't remember what the second half of that question was. I think it was about logistics.
Logistics, which what I would imagine, you know, setting up a base there and what might be involved with that.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, that's a really good question. I think something we're kind of still sorting out. You know, we obviously know that we'll need a place for the astronauts to sleep. We need a laboratory for them to work in. We need, you know, airlocks and all of these various things. We need rovers so that they can go distances well beyond the area where they're living and working. We'll need different robotic instruments to help with mining resources or doing experiments or conducting science. So there's a lot of logistics involved. And luckily, you know, we've got these great partnerships with our commercial vendors as well now. And so a lot of them have, you know, cargo landers as well as human rated landers. And so it'll be a delicate balance to get all of the supplies up there we need. But I would say as Artemis continues to move forward in the next few years, definitely keep your ears out because you'll start to hear a lot more about our plans for longer duration human stays on the moon.
Jeff, last summer, India becomes the fourth country to successfully land an object on the moon. How is NASA working with other national space agencies to achieve its goals? And what do you see around the world as you look to how countries are approaching the moon?
Yeah, that's a great question. International partnerships are a key part of the Artemis effort. NASA is working with Europe and Japan and Canada and other countries on elements of Artemis. That includes something called the Gateway, which will be sort of a little mini space station orbiting the moon that will serve as sort of a base camp for which astronauts will go down to the lunar surface from, to and from the lunar surface. You know, and the Gateway will consist of modules provided not just by NASA, but also by Europe and Japan and also the United Arab Emirates. They'll be contributing a module as well. And certainly as Artemis grows in the future, you'll see additional opportunities. Europe has talked about developing a lander for delivering cargo to the moon, provide some of the logistics we were just talking about that would be needed for a lunar base. Japan wants to develop a rover that would be able to be used by astronauts for long traverses across the lunar surface. So there's plenty of opportunities for those and other countries as well to participate in Artemis.
Ryan, China and America have plans to explore the lunar south pole in coming years. Why explore the southern reaches of the moon? Why is there this such interest in the southern reaches?
Yeah, there's a few reasons, one of which I mentioned earlier in the broadcast, that the south polar region has a lot of permanently shadowed regions. So these are areas that essentially never see sunlight. And so in these areas, we can we've detected that there are areas of water ice. These are great resources, obviously, for human exploration. If we want to stay for longer periods of time, you know, we can go and harvest these and use them for different applications. So that's one reason. Another is that, you know, we've never been to this area. There's whole new rock types that can tell us about the formation and evolution of the moon. We're going to be landing in some of the oldest terrains on the moon, So understanding exactly how old these terrains are and what the rock types are can tell us a lot about the evolution of the early moon, as well as the evolution of the Earth-Moon system. So it tells us a lot about our own planet. I do also want to say that while we're going to the South Polar region, that doesn't mean the other areas on the moon aren't also scientifically interesting. So we'll be exploring the entire lunar surface also with, you know, our robotic missions as well, even if we're not necessarily sending humans there right now.
Are human explorers like really the only way to get a definitive answer about whether there is water ice on the moon and what's going on with it?
So I would say that being on the surface of the moon is the only way to get the definitive answer. Okay. And there's a variety of ways we can do this. And I think kind of the best answer here is humans and robots working together. So in some of these permanently shadowed regions, there's often in the bottoms of craters that can be hard for crew to access. So if we bring crew and, you know, robotic rovers, for example, that are better able to traverse down into those areas, then the two working together is really useful. Sometimes you can have a robotic lander that can go in and take a sample of an area, and then the crew can go and retrieve it and bring it back later. So again, having humans there is really important because we can do things a lot more efficiently and quickly than robots, but we also need the robotic explorers as well to access some of these areas that are difficult for crew to get to.
Can you just even explain how valuable this water ice would be? Like what it would mean if crews didn't have to have water as part of their payload to get to the moon?
Yeah, so every pound or kilogram that you send to space, it doesn't even matter if you're going to the moon or not, but in this case to the moon, costs money. You know, the more mass that we send up on these spacecraft, the more expensive it is, the more difficult it is, the less room you have for other things, you know, more crew, more resources, more experiments, et cetera. So having resources readily accessible already on the surface of the moon would be really valuable because we could use those and not have to send as many supplies with the crew, thereby freeing up mass, saving money, et cetera. And again, it just kind of really helps us to use the resources there to enable sustained exploration for longer durations of time without necessarily needing to send as many resupply missions.
Talking about the moon and space exploration with Ryan Watkins, a NASA program specialist. Jeff Faust is here, Space News senior staff writer, and taking your questions at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jeff, NASA Director Bill Nelson says America is in a space race with China to get to the moon, and America is winning. Do you agree that the countries are in a type of space race here?
There is certainly a competition between China and the United States to get astronauts to the moon this decade. China is developing a very ambitious lunar exploration program. They've sent several robotic missions to the moon already. There will be launching another one later this year that will go to the far side of the moon and collect samples to return them to Earth. And they've talked about plans to send astronauts to the moon again to that South Polar region because of the ices there that Ryan mentioned by the end of the decade. So there certainly is a competition between the two, which I think you can see as part of the broader geopolitical competition between China and the United States on the global stage. Space is just one aspect of that. But certainly, you know, the United States is keeping a close eye on China and its growing space capabilities as it heads to the moon.
Your thoughts there, you know, Ryan, on how geopolitical competition would impact the Artemis mission?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, within NASA, with our Artemis program, we're not often focused on, you know, competition with other countries. We do recognize that, you know, China and other countries are looking at the South Polar region. Rather, we like to think about, you know, cooperation and what can be done there. There are, you know, some restrictions with China specifically, but as much as we can, we do talk to our international partners about, you know, where they're planning to land, where we're planning to land. You know, we have the Artemis Accords, which we've got several signatories from various countries and a lot of countries agreeing to kind of work together with a common understanding of what we want to do with the Artemis program. Again, it's a little trickier with China, but we do try to stay aware of, you know, what they're doing and you know, advertise kind of what we're doing so that we can work together as much as possible and avoid any conflicts as we're exploring similar areas.
Courtney in Eau Claire sent an email our way and is wondering, are we taking care to ensure we're not exploiting the resources the moon has? Ryan, what can you say there with Courtney's concerns about, you know, adequately caring for the resources?
Yeah, no, this is definitely a topic that comes up a lot. And we've actually had a workshop on Artemis and ethics and you know, exploration and how we can take care of, you know, the resources there and the environment. And I would highly recommend, I believe it's public now. I don't know the exact title of the report, but if you just like Google Artemis and ethics, you'll find a report that we wrote up about, you know, our thoughts and plans about how we can ethically explore and make sure that we're not exploiting resources. It is a very complicated, you know, topic to walk around, but it is very important to us at NASA that, you know, we take care of the environment we're in, while also trying to use what's there for, you know, scientific exploration and human exploration. So again, I highly recommend reading that report because it's got a lot more in it than I can possibly cover right now, but it is something that we're actively discussing, thinking about, talking to, you know, industry and academia about as well.
Let's bring in Steve in Lake Geneva. Steve, hi.
Yes, hi there. You mentioned that the United Arab Emirates is already participating in this effort to explore the moon, unlock its riches, presumably. What role does the fossil fuel industry have in this form of extreme human exploration? And what is the total estimated carbon footprint for this global space race? We know robots, for instance, are becoming far more sophisticated in can potentially significantly reduce costs. We also know that we have a climate and biodiversity crisis. So I'd just like to have your scientists put that into context. Thanks very much.
Into context. Steve, thank you. Ryan, you first.
Oh, yeah, that's a hard question. I'm not sure I have a very thorough answer for you. Again, I know people are thinking about these things, but I just don't, off the top of my head, know what the answer is. So I'm actually going to throw this one to Jeff to see if he's got any more to add.
And Jeff, I might add, are there efforts to work toward a more carbon neutral space flight program that would produce less waste? I mean, you know, I think it was with the reusable booster rockets that the rocket, you know, to the International Space Station. I mean, that might be an example.
Yeah, there's certainly an awareness of the need to be more sustainable in space. And sustainability, you know, takes several different dimensions. It includes, for example, reusable rockets. It includes looking at different kinds of propellants that may have less of an impact on the environment. It means leaving less debris in orbit, where it can pose a hazard to spacecraft in the International Space Station. So certainly people are thinking about it. You know, I don't know what the carbon footprint of the space industry is. It's probably relatively small compared to many other industries like aviation, simply because the sheer difference in size. And then to address the caller's question about the UAE, it's interesting is that one of the reasons why the UAE is getting involved in space is that they want to diversify their economy. They don't want to be just known as a country that produces oil, that they want to take advantage of that wealth and move into other industries. And space is one field where they see an opportunity to do that and create, you know, an economy that can last far longer than anyone that's based on fossil fuels alone.
Ryan, with the growing interest in lunar landings and the companies getting involved, are you concerned about space litter around the moon?
I'm not sure I would say I'm concerned, but I would say it's something that we definitely are talking about and thinking about, you know, with, you know, we're using some of these partners that Jeff just mentioned that have reusable spacecraft. I think we're still sorting out what aspects will be reusable and what aren't. With Apollo, you know, you may remember that we left kind of the bottom half of the lander on the surface, as well as, you know, other trash and such. With our HLS, Human Landing System, Those rockets, those landers, the whole thing will be leaving the surface. So we won't have an entire spacecraft still sitting there, but we will be leaving behind other things, you know, scientific payloads and, you know, probably some things the crew can't bring back. There may be some trash and stuff we have to leave. So as we start to look towards this increased cadence of surface missions, especially with humans, it is something we'll need to be thinking about. And I would say that those conversations are very much ongoing. And we welcome, you know, those conversations as well, because we do want to think about these things as much as we can.
Ryan Watkins is a NASA program scientist focused on the moon. Jeff Faust with us, senior staff writer at Space News. As we discuss developments in the space program, call in with a question. You can share your insights at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is music from the science fiction movie Dune Part 2 as we explore the real-life vision of NASA with its space program. We also hear your questions about getting to the moon and going beyond. Call in with a question. You can share your comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Ryan Watkins is a NASA program scientist focused on the moon. Jeff Faust is senior staff writer for Space News. Okay, Jeff, so Dune Part 2 released over the weekend, currently the best-selling movie of 2024, the year yet young. You know, how much does science fiction involving space affect our interest in real-life exploration and the work you do covering the space beat?
Well, I think that, you know, there's been a long-running tie between science fiction and science fact, if you will, when it comes to space. You know, I was inspired growing up by the original Star Trek series and the movies and the Next Generation series, for example. Many other people were as well. Other people turned to Star Wars or other series and so on. So I think there's always been a deep tie between the two, linking sort of the fantasies of what could happen in space with what really is going on and what could happen in missions to come.
Ryan, how do you negotiate that line between science fiction and science fact? And I just wonder how many times you roll your eyes like when watching movies.
Well, being a scientist, I probably roll my eyes more times than I should. That being said, you know, I do appreciate science fiction. You know, it kind of shows us just ways that the human brain can dream and envision like a future in space exploration. You know, some of it may be more realistic than others, but, you know, there's certainly no harm in having these kind of fantasies about, you know, what a future of humans living and working in space could look like. And, you know, there's certainly, you know, so again, like I said, some things are way more realistic than others, but no harm in having these visions of the future.
And no harm in asking, do you have a favorite space movie?
Oh, goodness. So my favorite is Apollo 13. I find it is obviously not a science fiction movie. It's based on a real story, but yeah. I just find it very inspiring, you know, just what the crew went through and how, you know, folks on the ground had to work so hard to bring them back safely. And obviously, you know, and had a happy ending. So that one is definitely one of my favorites.
And for you, Jeff?
Well, Apollo 13 is a great one. I mean, growing up, I remember seeing 2001 when it made a return to the theaters a number of years after it came out. And that sort of captivated me as sort of one vision for the future. You know, we're heading our way back to the moon. We don't have quite the space hotels yet, and hopefully we won't have HAL 9000. But other than that, you know, it was a fascinating movie.
Okay, so back to the real life space here. You know, last month, Jeff, you reported that their leak on the Russian side of the International Space Station has doubled in size. Part of the station has been in space now for nearly 30 years. What do you see as the future of the International Space Station?
Well, NASA's plans and the plans of the other partners on the ISS is to keep it operational through the end of the decade, to 2030. And even with the issues about the leak in that one part of the Russian segment, those plans seem to be holding up pretty well. What NASA is doing is trying to, again, leverage the private sector and partnerships there to develop commercial space stations that would serve as successors to the International Space Station, allowing NASA to give up the overhead and the cost of operating its own space station and instead using those commercial space stations to carry out some of the research that Ryan mentioned earlier on in our conversation in zero gravity in Earth orbit. And so it's supporting several companies that are working on these space stations. We'll see if they get them done by 2030 or not, if they run into delays. Many programs do run into delays in the space program. But certainly that is the future, is to gradually transition from the ISS to these commercial space stations.
Ryan, in our few moments we have left and in the years unfolding to 2026, what should we watch for next in the Artemis mission?
Yeah, there's a lot to watch for. This is a very exciting time in lunar exploration specifically, you know, space exploration in general, but we've got a lot going on in lunar exploration with our commercial lunar payload services program. So that's one thing to keep an eye out. We have two more launches coming up this year and several more in the following years. And those, you know, tie in to Artemis in various ways. Keep an eye out again for the Artemis 2 mission coming up. Again, this is a crewed orbital mission around the moon. I don't remember the exact date for that off the top of my head. I believe it's coming up next year. Keep an eye out for announcement of our Artemis 3 crew. So these will be the first astronauts to set foot on the surface of the moon in over 50 years. You know, we plan on sending the first woman and first person of color to the moon. So a lot to look out for that. And, and again, like Jeff was mentioning earlier, all these commercial ventures as well and how those are supporting space exploration has been really exciting to watch.
Ryan and Jeff, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That is Jeff Faust, senior staff writer at Space News, Ryan Watkins, program scientist in NASA's Exploration Science Strategy and Integration Office focused on the moon. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.